So I'm really interested not just in the lineage of Pete Seeger, but all these different ways that people have sung together. I'd like to do a Gregorian chant person, or the singing that was part of the South African Revolution, which was so powerful.
Welcome to Radio Free Space, WDRT's Community Access Hour. Today we feature Charlie Knower's interview with singer, songwriter, author, and educator Stuart Stotz, host of the podcast How Can I Keep From Singing?
In November of 2025, you premiered your podcast, How Can I Keep From Singing? We'll get back to that, but let's first talk about your long career as a singer, songwriter, storyteller, author, educator, and Kennedy Center teaching artist. How and when did you get started?
I performed back in college. I was with an Irish duo. I was doing some songwriting. I played with a jazz band for a little while. When I moved to Wisconsin, I wanted to be your average singer-songwriter, folk singer. And I did some shows. And I met a friend named Laurie Ellen Neustadt in about 1983. It was a time of great political unrest. At the time, it was about the nuclear freeze movement and disarmament. So we began to play together, and I wrote a bunch of songs there that were often political in nature. We played at rallies and clubs and all those kinds of things that aspiring folk singers do.
Let me interject, though. You wrote a bunch of songs, you said. How did you know that you could write songs? Sometime before this, you started writing the songs?
I started writing songs back in high school. And at the time, the way I learned to write songs was by writing words to other songs. So really just writing the lyrics. And when I got better at guitar later in high school, I started to write a song here and there. It wasn't a big thing for me, but I felt like I had learned enough by just listening to music and thinking about writing poetry and rhythm and so on, that the songs were okay, you know?
So this might be a good time to listen to some of your music. Around 1985, you recorded maybe your biggest hit, Music in My Mother's House. It must have felt good to have a large number of listeners early in your career, and I think you had other performers that covered it. Is that true? And then how did this song come to be available?
I wrote the song in 1985, but didn't record it till a few years later. I'm not sure. But I used to do a performance on my birthday of all the songs that I'd written in the previous year. And I'd invite friends over to my house. It must have been 1985 when I had 10 or 15 people gathered on my front porch, running through my songs that I'd written that year. And one of the songs I played was this Music in My Mother's House. And I thought it was kind of a throwaway song because it sounded so familiar to me. I'd written it on the bus one morning. But I had a couple of people after that come up and say, wow, that is a really great song. My friend Laurie Ellen Neustadt, who I was performing with, really grabbed onto it, partly because she was working a lot with older people and it spoke to them. She not only grabbed onto the song, but she also passed it after a concert to Ronnie Gilbert. And Ronnie Gilbert was one of the four members of the Weavers, such an influential group back in the 50s and 60s, Pete Seeger and so on. And Ronnie loved the song and began to play it in her concerts around the country. That led to a bunch of choirs, mostly women's choirs, who recorded it on their CDs. So the song really got passed around thanks to Laurie passing it to Ronnie, passing it to all these different choirs. And then a few other singers picked it up and recorded it as well.
There were wind chimes in the window, bells inside the clock, an organ in the corner, tunes in the music box. We sang while we were cooking or working in the yard. We sang although our lives were really hard. there was music. In my mother's house, there was music all around. There was music in my mother's house, and my heart still feels full with a sound. She taught us all piano, but my sister had the ear. She could play the harmony to any tune she'd hear. Now I don't play much talent, but I've always loved to play, and guess I will until my dying day. There was music in my mother's house, there was music all around. There was music in my mother's house, and my heart still feels full with a sound. Those days come back so clearly, although I'm far away. She gave me the kind of gift I love to give away. And when my mother died and she'd sung her last song, we sat in the living room singing all night long, singing la la la, la. Singing the front porch songs, singing the old torch songs, la la la, la la. Singing the hymns to send her home. There was music in my mother's house, there was music all around. There was music in my mother's house, and my heart still feels full with a sound.
Tell me how the songwriting process begins and who you aim for. Do you aim to have a hit? Do you aim to do it because you want to make a statement? Or are there other reasons?
Every songwriter, I think, wants people to hear and appreciate and ultimately record their songs or sing their songs. That's a great honor whenever someone does that. And I've been fortunate enough to have a number of folks record not just music in my mother's house, but some other songs as well. I don't know that writing a hit is how I proceed, because if I wanted to write a hit, I would want to move to Nashville or something and work with people and try to get something onto the country charts or the pop charts or whatever. So it's always been more about expression, just what is going on. John McCutcheon said many, many years ago, music is how we process being human. And I would say that in this case, songwriting is how I process being human. Something comes up, whether it's small and trivial or something huge, and a song will come out of it. I think, too, that some people are born with an artistic lens, and that's just the way that they see the world. And I, for whatever reason, was born with a songwriter's lens. So when something happens, I sort of translate that into song. Other people are born with a dance lens, or not even just artistic, a money lens or a structural engineer lens. But I'm always, and even more so now because I've been writing so many songs lately, always looking for, could that become a song?
We should tell the listener that on your Facebook page and on your Substack, you do put out a new song every week. And that's been happening for how long now?
It'll be 5 years in March. So that's something like 250 plus songs. And it's been this amazing artistic journey because I've never written as many songs as I have over the last 5 years. I would always every year write 10, 20, 25 songs. But this discipline of writing songs every week has contributed to a certain artistic momentum. And I've come to believe that one of the ways to be creative is just to continually sit down and be creative. And that opens up a certain gate. It's happened for me, and I know it's happened for other people as well. There's a way in which it's not simply relying on the inspiration that might come along, but saying, I'm going to sit down and offer a space for inspiration.
Going back to the artistic endeavor versus the number one hit, we're recording this at the time of the ICE occupation of Minneapolis. And there's popular songs coming out of that. I know just a few days ago, Bruce Springsteen wrote and sang and put out to the public his song about the occupation. Billy Bragg has done the same. Are you seeing fellow songwriters that you're aware of do this?
Absolutely. Any number of people that I know have written songs in response to the political turmoil, not just in Minneapolis, but over the last year. And I think you see two kinds of songs, speaking broadly. One is a song like Bruce Springsteen's, and I've written songs like this as well, that just address the issue, that talk about violence or response to violence, and they tend to be songs with a chorus and a verse and that expand on the theme. But what I've also seen in Minneapolis are any number of songs that are almost more like song fragments that people are using in marches and protests. These are songs that are easily learned. They may be two lines or four lines, and they arise out of the moment, very much like the civil rights movement. And these are songs that are not highly crafted, but they are easy to remember and easy to sing. So that is a whole other form of songwriting that's very population-based.
So referring back to your new podcast, that's a form of group singing.
Absolutely. And I've interviewed a couple people who are part of that movement or who have experienced singing in that way. Very different from being up on a stage and saying, let me lead you in song. It's more, let's start a song and watch the crowd pick it up. And you don't even know necessarily where it began.
Okay, moving on to World Citizen, where once again, you teamed up with Lori Ellen Newsted, and I think it was produced in Madison, Wisconsin, by the now very famous producer Butch Vig.
I wrote that song in 1983, I think, and I wrote it as a sing-along because it has a call and response. I'm a world citizen, and we would get crowds singing. It was fantastic to do it at a rally or something like that. That song we recorded on our album Good Friends in 1985. Which was recorded at Smart Studios with Butch Vig. And I can say this about Butch, that he was an amazing person to work with. You talk about an artist behind the mixing board. Butch was kind, he was patient, he was encouraging, he was technically savvy, he would give good feedback. I believe that Butch deserves every moment of fame and fortune that he has received. This is a guy who really knows how to work that board and knows how to work with artists.
Of course, a small town boy from Viroqua, Wisconsin, too.
That's right. And at the time, it was a little studio on East Washington and Madison with egg cartons stapled on the walls. And for that album, Good Friends, we financed it by asking people for, I think it was a $100 donation. And in return, one of the perks was getting to come into Smart Studios on a Saturday and sing on, I believe it was three of the songs. I know World Citizen was one of them. So we had them all, they were probably 40 or 50 people who came in, but they all had their picture on the back of the album, and Butch was the engineer. And we managed to corral these 30 or 40 people to do these takes of the songs to get the whole chorus feeling on the songs that were singable.
Regular folks around the world piece is what we're looking for. But it always seems like the ones on top keep on talking war. One of these days we'll be so strong, they'll get out of our way and help us build a peaceful world. And this is what we'll say. I'm a world citizen, step up and shake my hand. I'm not just from Wisconsin, not just American. I'm a world citizen, no around. You and I can break those borders down. You and I can break those borders down. You and I can break those borders down.
So moving quite a long ways forward now to 2021. You correct me if I'm wrong with the date, but that's when you took a trip to Tanzania, Africa, and were inspired to go back there originally and produce an album with local talent, which eventually became the 2021 winner of the Children's Album of the Year. And by the way, it's called Dance for the Elephants Lives.
When Heather and I went to Tanzania in 2015, we went with a tour operator named Ombeni. And at the last moment, I thought, I'm going to bring my banjo. So I brought my banjo, and it opened up all kinds of doors. I played banjo and sang with the Maasai warriors. And at every hotel, I would play and sing. And it made travel a very different experience. So when we went back, I guess it was a year and a half later, I decided to bring a guitar, and I asked Ombeni if he knew some musicians, because he's from Tanzania, and he set me up with some folks who came and played in the courtyard of a hotel, a drummer and a keyboard player and some singers. So we sat there and had a probably 25-minute jam on this one song, just sort of doing it over and over, and people were gathered around, and it was this fantastic experience. I decided at that time I'd like to come back and record, which Ombeni again made possible, gathered a group of musicians, and they were mostly singers. They were players as well, but the singing that they did was just beautiful, and that became the basis of this album, which I love. Out of all the things I've recorded, it's way up there in terms of my favorite, because it has these beautiful vocals of these Tanzanian singers who came in, and most of the songs were, in my mind, loosely based on the African experience. There's several about African animals and elephants and giraffes and monkeys, and they incorporate Swahili words, the songs often do. We weren't able to finish the album. We did 6 or 7 songs, I think. And then I finished the album during COVID with people that I could work with electronically from all over the world, someone from Nigeria, someone from Holland, people from Georgia. So it was quite an experience to assemble this whole album.
It's an amazing album. And knowing the story of how you went there, you played there, what an interesting thing to do on a vacation, of course. With music, you can meet so many people and become friends, but not only friends. You started a musical group, recorded with them, and then created what I think is a marvelous album.
It's the old cliche about music opening doors and forging connections. I've never experienced that as deeply as I did in my time in Tanzania. And whenever possible, traveling with an instrument just makes something happen.
Ngoma zetu, miziki yetu.
Then on that same album, you put two songs that are fascinating to me. One is called Miss the More Than You Make, and the other one is called Duke at the Piano. This is full-blown Django Reinhardt. Tell me what prompted this.
Miss More Than You Make is a result of thinking about the hunting that animals do in the Serengeti and other places, where in fact they miss way more than they make. They chase a lot more animals than they actually catch. And that seemed like a good metaphor for life as well. You're going to miss more than you make. Thinking that it's easy is your big mistake. You're going to miss more than you get. But missing just means you haven't got it yet. So there's a little bit of a lesson in all of that. Animals are incredible to get the opportunity to be near them. And Duke at the Piano was inspired by hearing this story about Duke Ellington, how Duke, after a concert, would just want to sit and play for himself. That was his real time. He was out there performing and he did a good job, but then he was so filled with melodies and harmonies that he wanted to create that he would just sit at the piano by himself. And I recorded both of those songs with Chris Wagner and Mary Gaines, incredible musicians in Madison. And they both have that sort of swing, Django Reinhardt-y kind of feel, but I just played guitar, they did the rest.
Lioness hunts her quarry with all her wily tricks. With power and speed, she'll succeed maybe one time out of six. Well, she just keeps on trying. She won't want to quit. It's a lesson in surviving. Well, she will tell you this is it. You're gonna miss more than you make. Thinking that it's easy is your big mistake. You're gonna miss but more than you get. But missing just means you haven't got it yet. You haven't got it yet. Cheetah fast as lightning, animal in her prime. She chases a gazelle, but it comes out well. Well, less than half the time. Well, she just keeps on trying. She won't run away. Lesson in surviving. And this is what she'd say. You're gonna miss more than you make. Thinking that it's easy is your big mistake. You're gonna miss but more than you get. But missing just means you haven't got it yet. You haven't got it yet. Ooh, Simba and Duma don't learn this in school. Civilized or wild at heart, well, there's a simple rule. Hunts a zebra, lion hunts giraffes, leopard leaps and the jackal creeps, hyena just sits and laughs. We're in the Serengeti, like anywhere.
Switching gears again, you've written many books, starting out, I think, with one about ghosts, but also Curly Lambo, Building the Green Bay Packers, Father Grappi, the civil rights leader who was my neighbor, the story of the Good Samaritan through the windows of Chartres Cathedral, and We Shall Overcome, a song that changed the world. And the foreword to that book was written by Pete Seeger. Tell me more about how you started writing books and how you made subject choices and finally how you met Pete Seeger.
I think all those books are driven in some way by having a story to tell. So ghost stories were a big thing because I've worked so much with kids in schools. And as a storyteller, Kids love ghost stories. It's just this, I think adults do too, a good ghost story. So my friend Elizabeth Mattson and I went out and literally collected stories from people in southwestern Wisconsin, sit down and talk with them, and took the good ones and put them into the book. So these weren't stories that were created so much as retold. Following that, maybe it was about 10 years later or so, I wrote the Ludi Stearns book, which you know quite a bit about. And Ludi was a real heroine of mine in the early 1900s, taking books around to post offices, railroad stations, and so on in boxes because they didn't have libraries. Ludi was a strong believer in the power of education to lift people up and also to help with democracy, that a more informed population would make better choices. A good friend of the La Follettes and a friend of Jane Addams, this whole progressive era, 125 years ago. And following that, I wrote some biographies. At one point, maybe 15 years ago, I started thinking about what song really matters in the world. And you could list a number of them, but the one that came to me was We Shall Overcome. So I began to research that, and the book went through a bunch of different ideas. I thought it might be an oral history of people who had encounters with the song, but eventually it turned into sort of a biography of the song. And in the creation of the book, I was able to do interviews with Pete Seeger for several hours over the phone to talk about where that song came from, as well as other people, Frank Hamilton and Guy Carawan and more, because the song had such an impact at the time of the civil rights movement. The book was really intended for sort of upper elementary, middle school aged kids, but I think it gives adults a really good overview of not only the song, but something about the civil rights movement. And in addition, the way the song has traveled around the world to places like India and Pakistan and other places where the song's been picked up as a symbol of resistance and resilience and overcoming.
Full disclosure here, I'm mentioned in that book, and mentioned because I talked to you about time in 1970 after the U.S. had invaded Cambodia. There was a rally and a protest on the mall at the Capitol, and I attended. I was in school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison at the time. And there was so many people, and I was dazzled by the number of people there, and there was one performer after another and a speaker one after the other. And I was beginning to think, this is really not going anywhere. It felt like it was not cohesive, that the crowd wasn't involved with it. And almost as soon as I thought that, Pete Seeger stepped up to the microphone. And this really gets me. I really get a little choked up thinking about it because it's a old memory. But he had his banjo and his voice, and he played We Shall Overcome. And within seconds, the crowd was with him. There was a silence in the 100,000 people there. And I just thought, this is marvelous. And this is one of the reasons I think these anti-Vietnam War protests were successful.
I love that story so much, and I'm grateful that you told it to me and I was able to include it in the book, because I think it encapsulates the experience that thousands and thousands of people have had about the power of group singing. And Pete Seeger was the master, of course. But this way in which it creates, as you describe it, a cohesion, a focus, a sense of connection, and inspiration. Really, it's at the bottom of the podcast that I started, because I wanted to explore that power of group singing through a variety of interviews. And the one person that I can't interview that I wish I could is Pete Seeger.
Since we're talking about Pete Seeger at this point, would you tell the story about him when he was in Barcelona in Spain and he went on stage?
So Pete's recordings traveled around the world, and when he recorded that We Shall Overcome album, he then went on a world tour, and everywhere he went around the world, people knew the song because the recording had preceded him. I don't know the year, but he was in Barcelona in Spain, in Franco's Spain, a fascist state, and had a large audience in front of him who'd come to hear. And right before he went on, the members of the junta, the military, gave him a list and said, these are songs you are not allowed to sing. And of course, these were songs about politics and repression and standing up. So they censored him right before he was going to go on. So Pete took the list and went out. There is a microphone facing thousands of people. And he said something to the effect of, well, I've been told I can't sing these songs, but they haven't told me that I can't play them. So I'm going to play them because I think you know the words. And he proceeded to play, I mean, We Shall Overcome and I Don't Know What Other Songs. And sure enough, the crowd responded. So he was an accompanist there, got around this attempted censorship. And I wrote a song about that story because I think it's so powerful. And it says something also about the way in which his music just sort of penetrated the world.
Part of the song is the crowd grew eager, 100,000 strong. They'd come for Pete Seeger, his banjo and his songs. In Franco's Barcelona, the tyrant's long years, the music of freedom, folks were hungry to hear. What an inspiration Pete continues to be, right?
He really does. And to bring it back to Minneapolis, I think it's the exact same force going on there. When I see all these videos of people marching or in churches singing these songs to give themselves, again, strength and connection and resilience.
Let's not forget, we went off on a segue with Pete Seeger because of the book that you wrote about We Shall Overcome. But there's one more book that I think is maybe your most important, and that's the children's book that you wrote about kindness.
Because I've worked a lot in schools and I've worked with teachers and done a lot of teacher training, I have conversations with folks all the time. And maybe 12, 13 years ago, a persistent theme kept surfacing, and that theme was kindness. Teachers are often concerned with behavior. How do I get people, kids, to stop talking or throwing things or hitting each other? But kindness was a different thing. Kindness is this internal attitude of looking at someone else and wondering what you can do for them. It's not the same as being nice, which is kind of how we lubricate our social interactions through manners and so on. But kindness is this much deeper sense of the other person. And I loved thinking about that. So I wrote a book about it that had a brief exploration of the idea of kindness, looking at it culturally through history. And then it's filled with a bunch of different thematic ways to explore kindness with young children. We're talking here 3, 4, 5 year olds. How do you explore kindness through food, through gardening, through being outdoors, and so on? And I love the book because it takes what is kind of an ephemeral subject like kindness and makes it solid in terms of ways we can not so much teach it as nurture it.
You made another shift in your career, and it's been at least 20 years ago, I'm guessing. Correct me if I'm wrong. And that's when you became a Kennedy Center teaching artist. Tell me about that.
Well, I can't talk about it now without a sense of grief because of what's happened to the Kennedy Center under the current regime. But the Kennedy Center was dedicated, among other things, it's a performing arts center, so they bring in, you know, the highest quality performers of all kinds of genres, but it was also dedicated to educating people. How can we build an informed population, especially among children, that will continue to support the arts and understand the arts and appreciate the arts as they get older? There was a roster of teaching artists from around the country, Kennedy Center partners all over the states, and did workshops for teachers to help them think about what they could do, not to come in and perform for teachers, but to try to teach them some small bit of what the artist does that the teacher could then use to incorporate into their instruction. So I did workshops on music writing and workshops on storytelling in particular, because storytelling is such an accessible art form. And if teachers incorporate it more, then it has implications for literacy and related things like, you know, vocabulary and sequencing, but also a sense of cultural awareness, because folk tales tell us a lot about where we came from and the cultures that we're part of. So that was a wonderful program. It's gone now, but it was a fantastic way to work with teachers, but also to meet these other artists who are, you know, dancers and drama and puppets and poets who were also on this journey to how do we sustain the arts over time by working with teachers so something of what we do can remain after we're gone.
Okay, now we've come full circle and we'll talk about the new podcast, which began in November of 2025. Specifically, and I say specifically because that's what I'm going to play the episode after this interview, you did one podcast with the New Hope Baptist Church of Birmingham, Alabama. You went there prior to doing a podcast and then did the podcast. Tell me the story behind this.
I was in Birmingham presenting at an early childhood conference, and I wanted to go to a gospel choir because I knew there'd be something good down there in Alabama, and found one on the internet that seemed to be pretty highly regarded, the New Hope Church, and I went there, and I just loved it. And Charlie, I don't know that there is another kind of music that lifts people's spirits the way gospel music does. That's exactly what the experience was being there. It was about a three-hour service, you know, and this choir was improvisational and full-spirited and responsive to what was going on both within the choir and also out in the congregation. So when I thought about this idea of group singing, I wanted to include them in the podcast. So I interviewed three of the people involved there at the church, because if I could come back as anything, I would come back as a gospel singer, because I just think that it's so powerful. And it's no surprise to me that the civil rights movement songs were based off of that kind of feeling. I just interviewed a woman named Jane Sapp, who was involved in the civil rights movement and also has this deep gospel background. And it was that same feeling of, we are here to sing and be filled up with the Spirit.
How do you find new people to interview? Is it a problem for you to find them, or are they finding you? You've done one once a week for quite a number of weeks now. What selection are you looking at?
I think I started with sort of my own network, which tends to be, you know, folk singers who are singing with people and encouraging them in concerts or workshops to find their voice. But I've gotten now where people are recommending other folks. So I'll give you an example of a few of the episodes that I've had that aren't just sort of here we are at a concert, Pete Seeger-like. I interviewed recently someone who takes people into the woods and they experience creating music with nightingales in England. I interviewed someone to talk about the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I interviewed someone who has a whole organization called Tuneless Choirs, which is for people who have no confidence and want to sing, but their choirs essentially without standards. and yet they're so much fun. People just, you know, exuberantly letting their voices out. I interviewed someone about shape note or sacred harp singing. So I'm really interested not just in the lineage of Pete Seeger, but all these different ways that people have sung together. I'd like to do a Gregorian chant person, or the singing that was part of the South African Revolution, which was so powerful. So I haven't had a shortage yet. At some point, I'll have done enough. But right now, there's still a lot. And I think I'm sort of creating almost like a reference library for people who are interested in the power of singing together. Interviews with 20 or 30 experts from a bunch of different perspectives about why singing together is so powerful, and a little bit about how to do it.
You've been listening to an interview with Stuart Stotz here on Radio Free Space. Let's listen now to one of Stotz's podcasts, How Can I Keep From Singing?, which details his magical musical experience with the New Hope Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama.
For thousands of years, humans have sung together, creating harmony, beauty, community, and joy. Here on How Can I Keep From Singing, we talk about this ancient art form, exploring the power, and some of the how-to. I'm your host, Stuart Stotz, coming to you from rural Wisconsin. My guests today are from the New Hope Baptist Church in West End near Birmingham, Alabama. I was fortunate to be in Birmingham a couple of months ago and to get to hear the New Hope Choir and experience the power of the whole service. I met Pastor Clark at the time, and we connected later about being part of this podcast. The choir at New Hope has a long and powerful tradition of meeting ministry with music. Earlier this year, the choir was named the nation's best choir at the highly competitive Sound Awards in Dallas. They've been featured in other settings, and every year they set a high standard for gospel music. With me here today are Pastor Clark, Minister of Music Michael Mays, and Gayani Dotson, President of the Mass Choir. Welcome to How Can I Keep From Singing?
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Such a pleasure to have you all here. Every time I mention gospel music, people's faces light up. What is it about the power of gospel music itself that has such a transformative and powerful impact on people?
Well, I believe gospel music is something, it's a genre of music that actually you can't play around with, because what's loaded with it when you change the atmosphere, certain things happen when you sing just gospel music. So you have other genres when you sing jazz, when you sing blues, when you do hip hop, those actually make you feel good, just maybe in the emotional area. But I think once you sing gospel and you call on the name of Jesus, the whole atmosphere of what you are going through shifts and changes. So gospel music is, I believe, is one of the, if not the most powerful genre of music that there is.
You certainly can't separate it from the religion and the service and the ministry that it's part of. It's not just an art form.
It's important in our church here to have music. Is vital. It is a tradition that New Hope has had for many, many, many years, long before I became pastor. But it's continued as long as I've been here, that we place a very high emphasis on making sure that we have good music, good quality sound, instruments, and singers, and so forth, because it is of the utmost importance in our congregation.
There's a long tradition of gospel music there. How has that changed over the years? Pastor Clark, I know you've been there a while. How has gospel music, or the music in the service, how's that transformed over the last, let's call it 30 years or so?
We are fortunate to have several forms of music. You've heard our mass choir, but we have a praise team. We have an ensemble. We have a male chorus. We have a children's choir. We have so many different outlets for people to participate, and all of our groups are excellent under the direction of our minister of music that makes sure that we maintain a certain standard and quality of music here.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Obviously, the quality of music there is just superior. How do you do that?
Honestly, this started before me. I'm the third minister of music here at the New Hope Baptist Church. The very first one was Dr. John David Brown, and then the second one was Dr. Minister Prince Yelder. Now, under Prince Yelder, I served as a musician. So I was able to learn a lot as I was just serving as a musician. And so then when my time came to become the minister of music, I was able to step into the role because I knew what it took to make this service. New Hope is just a different church compared to others when you talk about music. The level of excellence here is really, really, really high. I mean, the guys before me, again, John David Brown, that's a living legend. God rest his soul. And Dr. Yelder, he's a living legend in himself. You cannot mention Birmingham, Alabama without mentioning Dr. Prince Yelder. So these guys have paved the way. And so I'm just a little fella that's just trying to hold up the standard, because these guys have done 15 years. I'm only on year 3. So I'm just trying to hold it up and just keep the standard going.
Well, it sounds like you're doing that. And I guess what I'm wondering is, what are the ingredients? What are the pieces? Why is there such excellence there? I understand there's a long tradition, but what makes up that tradition to make it so powerful and recognized.
I just think it was birthed here in this church. I mean, that's just something that's just, when you come here to this church, the ingredient is you're going to come in with excellence. We're going to give it our all, regardless on what ministry you're a part of, you're going to give your best. So you learn the meal of the music, you learn the message of the music. So delivering it to the audience, you know exactly what it is, the message that we're trying to convey. So it's a lot of ingredients. It's, you know, a lot of prayer, a skill, studying. It's a lot that goes into it, but I'm just so grateful that we are able to make it happen.
You're listening to How Can I Keep From Singing? My name is Stuart Stotz, and I'm here with members of the New Hope Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama.
Because of the standard attracts people that want to participate. We have a lot of great voices, a lot of that solo quality, but they're willing to sing, you know, it has to be the same background to be a part of this. And Glennie may be able to tell a little bit more about the choir, because she's been part of for such a long time and experienced a lot of travel and everything with our choir.
It's an experience that, I mean, it's just almost out of this world. I became a member of the choir under Dr. John Brown. I was 8 years old. It's just something about it. You know, when you know, Sundays when we know we're going to sing, you know, I be geared up. You know, they call me the dancing soprano. You know, I move. You know, if you on my road, you're going to have, you know, you may get knocked down by me. It's no telling. But, you know, we have our praise team here. The mass choir come, we bring the vegetables, right? So you got your bread, you got your vegetables. Then our pastor come with the meat. Well, we don't have to stay for dessert because we threw after the message. You know, so it's just time to go lay down and rest because I be tired when we get through singing, you know. And it's just a fun experience, you know. And when we are out, and we say, I know you singing the New Hope Mass Choir, you know, that makes you feel good, you know, and people come to hear the choir.
So your whole body is part of it. It's not just taking place up in your throat or your mouth. There's a real sense of being completely engaged from what I could see and from what you're talking about.
The past, you know, it's just a joy. You never know how a person is feeling when they come into church and they hear us sing. You know, we always say, it's not about us, it's about giving God the glory. And, you know, you never know what a person is going through. You know, and if our singing can uplift a person to keep them from doing something crazy, then, you know, we've done, you know, what God has sent us here to do.
It seems like the word uplifting is the best adjective to think about when I think about gospel music. It's there to lift us up.
Yes.
What is the relationship between the song and improvisation? When I was there, the songs, first of all, they're a lot longer than in the standard church where I might come from, where you have sort of your 3-minute hymn, right? And I think that they're also being improvised some. It's not, you're not just reading from a sheet. Talk a little bit about how that works.
Okay, so a lot of that comes from improvisation. When you improv, a lot of times is what we allow the spirit to move. And so once we get into a situation, I may say, and that's where she goes back to say, watch. We may have this certain situation set up, but once the spirit moves, I can be in the middle of something and I feel like this house needs to hear this message right here. I'm able to get in contact with my band director and he leads the band to where it is that I want to go. And because I've told them so many times to watch, we are able to transition because they know just to watch. And so a lot of times you'll get one song that may start here, but we may improv and go to a whole nother song that it still simultaneously has the same message, but just the songs may have a different feel. I think that leads to a lot of improv. A lot of times I may just have a different, I love the message of a song, but maybe the feel, I may want to give it a different feel. That's another way of improv. So my biggest thing when my choir comes to choir rehearsal is I tell them, don't put us in a box. You can't put us in a box. You may hear a song a certain way, but when you come to New Hope Baptist Church, you may hear the same song, but it may be in a different form, and it may relate to you in a different way. So I think a lot of that is where the improv comes from.
Where do you begin? You've got songs. Are they songs that are created within the church? Is there a tradition of gospel music that you're drawing from? Where do you start?
In the Baptist church, we have what's called gospel standards. So, of course, you have your hymns. But as far as choir, we have what's called choir standards. Basically, what that means is if you go to certain Baptist churches, you will normally hear these songs done by church choirs. But because New Hope has a different standard, we may present it to you in a different way than the normal Baptist church may present it to you. You have songs that you can create. We have songs that we've heard from different artists. We have songs even that our church has recorded before. We may go back and we may redo those. So there's just, it's so many ways and so many dictionaries I can pull from that gives me songs that I can do here at the church.
Right. You've got this whole material to draw from.
Yes, sir.
Pastor Clark, I noticed also, I believe this is a gospel tradition. As your sermon came to an end, you moved into what I would call kind of a singing or a sing-song thing. Is that what you usually do? It's very powerful to hear that. And it feels like it connects to the music that's part of the rest of the service.
As a Black pastor of a Black church, our culture is very rhythmic. We relate to rhythm. We relate to certain cadence. And a lot of the Black Baptist churches, they know that when the pastor, the preacher is up and is coming to the close of the message. He changes the tempo from what may have been a little bit monotone, goes into something that is rhythmic. And our people relate to that because it kind of emulates, we have a kind of a sing-song mentality. And so it kind of connects back to the music that's going
steal
on.
Steal away, steal away. Steal away.
You're listening to How Can I Keep From Singing? My name is Stuart Stotz, and I'm talking today with members of the New Hope Baptist Church from Birmingham, Alabama.
Got your own praying ground. God will send a messenger to meet you there. Have I got a witness here? And all you need is just one touch. Just one touch can change.
Pastor, you mentioned the Black culture, and gospel music, of course, comes out of that. There's a relationship somewhat to the spirituals, which are much older and more in the folk tradition, not necessarily composed, but also that attempt to address some of the suffering that the Black community has gone through. How do you see that as part of your ministry and the music you're presenting?
It's ironic that you mentioned that because just this past Sunday, I deviated from the norm of the certain selections that the choir has sang, but I went back and did one of the old traditional type of hymns, whether it's congregational. And so I from time to time, I'll go back and do it just to remind us of our culture and of our history so that we don't ever get lost from that and have the congregation to participate in the singing.
In the service, as I recall, and I may not have this quite right, you have the choir singing, improvising, people taking parts and so on, but the congregation is not singing as much. There's some singing. Talk a little bit about that, because often in churches, like I come from a Protestant Presbyterian church, you know, you have a choir, but the choir is really, they'll do one piece. But most of all, it's the congregation singing, and not very well, I might add. But so.
Yeah, so usually here at our church, I think the people come to more so enjoy. And then once they learn the song, because I try to do my best when I present a song, I first time I just want to present it to you, to introduce it to you. And then once we come back and do it again, hopefully the message has conveyed it to you, so now you're able to sing the song with us. Now, once we've done it again, now you recognize that, hey, this song is a part of me. I understand the message of this song. I can sing this at home. I can sing this on my way to work. I can sing this, you know, while I'm picking my kids up from school. So it's more so of a, we come to enjoy the choir. Now, we do have a couple of selections that I do. that does involve the congregation to sing along with us. We don't, most churches, now I do understand they do a hymn every week, you know, that they'll do, you know, hymn after hymn every week. We're not set up that way. But you will catch us if, like you said, when we do our improv, we are quick to go into a hymn at the drop of a dime. And once that happens, once you say the first two lyrics to a hymn in this church, the whole church join in. They take the song over. So we do it once it happens, though, but we're not a weekly, let's all stand, turn our hymn books to page 323. You know, we just don't do that here at our church.
Can you talk a little bit about a time you can remember where you just felt the music take you?
Well, today is my sister's birthday, but she passed about 2 years ago. It was a song we were singing, something about joy or something. It made me feel better because me and my sister had such a close relationship, and she, you know, passed from cancer, you know. And then after we sung the song, I was full. And then, you know, our pastor came and preached on grief. And that helped me so much. You know, I've had a couple of deaths in my family. I had two nephews to pass back to back. You know, it's just the songs that, like I said, you never know what a person is going through. And sometimes there are certain songs that we sing and they really touches me and helps me, you know, go through what in my mind that I'm, you know, going through.
It's certainly true that songs have a huge role in grief and loss.
Well, we sing a lot of songs that express joy and praise. We're very high on praise here because we always want to acknowledge that even whatever situations in our life we're going through, that God is in charge, and we thank Him for who not just for what He does, but for who He is. So we try to emphasize that praise mentality as well.
I felt that very much in the church, that praise and connection with each other, connection to God, was very much at the heart of what you were singing about. I want to thank the three of you so much for talking with me today. If I had a message, I would simply say, go to Birmingham to the New Hope Church and take it in, because you offer, and on the first and third Sunday, I think, in particular. I'm just so moved by having the privilege of being there and now the privilege of talking with all of you. All the best to you in maintaining that excellence and that sense of deep spirit that you have. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you, and you're welcome here anytime.
I hope to be back.
Any grateful folks, you've been...
You've been listening to How Can I Keep From Singing, a production of Common Arts. My name is Stuart Stotz, and today my guests were from the New Hope Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama.
You've been listening to Radio Free Space, WDRT's Community Radio Access Hour. Today we featured an interview with Stuart Stotz, host of the podcast How Can I Keep From Singing, episodes of which are available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you have a show you would like to produce for Radio Free Space, contact Terry O'Connor, WDRT's Programming and Operations Coordinator, at terry@wdrt.org. Today's program was produced by Charlie Noer and yours truly, Bill Motlong.